This is tape number one on lesson one of Revelation. One of the most important things in studying Revelation is a general overall idea of the flow of events. In order to understand any section of a map, we must see the map as a whole and understand how our particular section is related to the rest. Otherwise, it can only be a piece of isolated and unoriented information, which could be worse than useless. It could be misleading. A general design of a building with a complete plan and blueprint is necessary before any one part of it can be understood or worked on. And so here, in this book of Revelation, the student is urged to read right through the book a number of times rapidly, without worrying too much about the details or the meaning of them, just to catch the general picture. This will certainly make the book much less overpowering. The general rhythm of events will fall into place and become very much clearer. It must be kept in mind that God says the book is a revelation, an unveiling, not a hiding or a mystifying. He says this unveiling was given to show to his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it to his servant John. The word show connects itself with the visions of the book, while the word signified is linked in the original with that of sign, would refer to the symbols. But all is for revealing, showing, informing, and it has been the devil's great success that he has convinced so many that the book is too mysterious and difficult and confusing to be read at all. This, of course, is the old Roman hierarchy's trick of telling its adherents that the whole Bible is too hard and should be left alone. We laugh at Rome, and yet we fall into the trap of believing the same kind of thing about the book of Revelation. Note also that it is a book sent specifically to servants, active people, not just Christians, or saints, or sons for that matter, but servants, those working at his business, showing us that it has practical value. It is for practical people. This is reinforced by the statement of verse 3, where a special blessing is pronounced on him who publicly reads the book, on those who hear it, and on those who keep the things written. This keeping in John is John's usual word, as for example in 1 John 2:4, for obeying the commands of God. So it's a book to be obeyed. You may wonder, in view of the book's character, how this can be, but a moment's thought will make the point very clear. The book, for example, shows us a world in total revolt against God, crucifying his Son, blaspheming his name, murdering his witnesses, accepting as a substitute for Christ a satanically inspired dictator pictured as a blood-smeared, ravening wild beast. And finally, the world is represented as banding together all its nations against God and against his Christ to destroy his people and his city. The obedient Christian will know what his proper relations with such a world are to be, and he will act according to the revelation. He will obey. The book also shows us Christ enthroned above all this world chaos, King of kings and Lord of lords, even the one seen, except by faith, and the obedient Christian will understand his proper relationship with such a Lord, the Supreme One, even during his Lord's absence. This too calls for obedience. The book also shows us the world under the judgment of God, and actually living on the very verge, the very eve, of the outbreak of this judgment. The obedient Christian will be living accordingly. He will not be mixed up in a world under judgment. The book closes with the trumpet call, "Behold, I come quickly," and the obedient Christian will want to be living as one who waits for his Lord. The Spirit of God after the unveiling would ask his servants, seeing all these things must come to pass, what kind of people ought you to be in a totally holy way of life with godlikeness? So you see, running our lives in keeping with what this book reveals to us of the plans of God will make us a very different people and a very happy or blessed people. And it does call for obedience to its message. It is also a very stimulating and encouraging book for the Christian. John, who saw Christ on a cross during his lifetime, now sees him in glory. It also outlines the inevitability of judgment, the supremacy of Christ, the complete control and dominance of heaven, even when we might think that things had broken loose. God has his hand on everything. Christ is pictured in the first part of the book, enthroned in the hearts of the Christians of this present church age. In the second section of the book, he is enthroned in the hearts of the Jewish and Gentile remnants during the tribulation. In the third part of the book, he is seen on the throne of the 1,000-year earthly kingdom. Then he is seen on the great white throne of final judgment. And at last, he is seen on the throne of universal sovereignty. What an inspiring theme for Christian living under Nero or Domitian, hounded, scattered, or living in the gloomy labyrinths of the catacombs, while the aged disciple, whom Jesus loved and honored, is alone in exile on a rocky desert island, and the church is nearer to extinction than at any time before or since. Night after night, the sports arenas of Rome were filled with cheering Romans, watching multitudes of Christ's ones being tortured and killed. At such a time comes an unveiling of an established throne of authority in heaven, where all is calm and under control, where the church is told the exact number of days of its persecutions, where no single thing can happen on earth apart from its initiation in heaven, where the groaning prayers of suffering saints are heard and are answered in ultimate and inevitable judgment on their tormentors, even though this must await God's timing. What an effect this would have on suffering and weary Christians. It should have the same effect on us, of course, if perhaps in different directions. The main divisions of the book are given in the lesson material and need not be labored in this introductory outline, except to re-emphasize the God-given analysis in chapter 1, verse 19. God here divides the book into three parts. The things which thou hast seen, that is, Christ himself, personally, in chapter 1, and giving his character as he moves around among the local congregation of Christians. 2, the things which are, the present existing things of chapters 2 and 3, the church as represented by the 7 lampstands shining in a place of moral darkness, the present church age. And 3, the things which shall be after these. This last covers chapters 4 to 22, and is, properly speaking, the prophetic part of the book. Since the contents of chapter 1, as a demonstration of the character of Christ, is perfectly straightforward, and chapters 2 and 3 have to do with the church, this leaves us 18 chapters of purely prophetic study. So you see, we have already cut the material to a more manageable size. One or two other things should be underlined in this analysis, though they are partly mentioned in the printed lesson material. 1, the chronological development of the prophecy is given in what is said of the 7 seals, the 7 trumpets, and the 7 vials or bowls. So, if you read the book with a sheet of paper and a pencil, marking down the parts actually dealing with these three groupings, you will have the main framework and movement of the whole book, that is, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials. The second thing is, in between these main sections handling the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, you will find a number of pauses or breaks in the movement of the narrative in which further background material and information is given about some individual or some part of the event so that we may better understand the action. In the middle of page 6 of the lessons, these parentheses or pauses are given as 12 in number, and this is quite correct. But you will have noticed that the middle 9 occupy chapters 10 to 14, so that this whole section of 5 chapters is in fact one long parenthesis, one long break in the narrative, further cutting down our 18 chapters to 13, since these parenthetical bits can be studied by themselves separately. We note, too, that all of chapter 7 is a parenthesis, telling us about the preparing of Jewish witnesses for God's work after the church is removed, and also about the results of their work in a great multitude of all nations saved through them. These explanations are given between the 6th seal, chapter 6, verse 12, and the 7th seal, chapter 8, verse 1. They also tell us that the saved ones had come out of the Great Tribulation, yet this has really not started. So it can be clearly seen that what we mean by this being a parenthesis. These pauses are like what is done in a film or a videotape of some event, a game, a battle, a study of some kind. We are watching a documentary or sequenced chronological account of the action, when suddenly this movement is stopped, and we are given materials spliced into the account to explain something of one of the characters or players involved so that we can better understand how he got there, why he is there, when he came, etc. It may take us backward for hours or days or years in his personal history. It may give us a replay of some previous part of the game or even another game altogether. It sometimes shows us, if it is not being watched live, the crossing of the finishing line, the end of the game, and then flash back to the beginning to follow through the play-by-play action to explain why the end was as it was. This is exactly what happens in the pause or parenthetical portions of Revelation. We have already seen them cut the whole down to 13 chapters. But if we take out chapter 17, 18, which deal parenthetically with the judgment of Babylon, the false religious system, and 4 and 5, which are preparatory scene setting, we have no more than 9 actual chapters or 150 verses, and this makes for a much less awesome task. So, let us take courage and start.